Welcome to Entrepreneur Clinic with me, Monique Chambers, and every week I'll be interviewing a special guest talking about how to set up a business or how to launch a new product in the local market. Welcome to Entrepreneur Clinic with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week, John DiGiorgio from Sherbin Software. This week, we're discussing internationalization. So, isn't internationalization just your selling your product overseas?
No. If it were that easy, then things would be a lot more successful for a lot more people. Selling is obviously an important part, the actual sales process, but there's a lot of additional background and preparation that you need to have, different skills. And it's also particularly important to understand the nature of the market that you're addressing, both from a sectoral point of view and also from a geographic point of view. So there are quite a few nuances to internationalization, part of which is the selling process.
So do you mean there are cultural differences in the way you would sell to somebody of a different nationality?
I would say so, yes. Your ability to sell in and the way that you would sell in a market like Italy, for the sake of argument, is going to be quite different to the way that you would do so in the UK or in the US market. It's not just about culture in the way that we might actually think about it, but also you are, to a certain extent, battling certain prejudices that people might have in a market. For instance, the Italians are usually a lot happier buying from an Italian company.
Okay.
So that's something which is much more prevalent, in my experience at least, than is the case, for instance, in the UK. So these differences are very important, and you do need to play those differences to maximize the opportunity that you might have within a particular market.
So is it as easy as having somebody who speaks Italian in that scenario, or is it even more complex than that?
No, speaking Italian, just to use that as an example, in other words, speaking the language of the people that you're trying to sell to, definitely is an advantage. Even though, of course, English is very widely spoken, more so in certain geographies and also certain sectors than in others, speaking the language of the people you're selling to is an advantage. But it's not just about that. You need to be able to position your product to the specific aspects which are driving the demand for a particular product or service that you might have.
Okay.
And the thing which is driving the demand may be different in one market to another market. I don't know, perhaps I can give you an example.
Yes, please.
Of this. We're operating in the airport sector, where we have developed a software product for the airport market. And what this does is it controls the commercial activities in an airport. So it's typically retail and food and beverage type concessions and others. Now, some markets, the main driver for the airport who might be looking at buying our CA Plus product would be that they want to control the concessionaires.
So that's the shopkeepers, etc.
Correct. So they want to control to make sure that when they are reporting back their sales, they're reporting back their sales in a complete and correct manner.
I see.
In a different market, for instance, a North European market, a Scandinavian, a UK market, control is less of an issue because it's expected that the shopkeepers will be reporting correctly. So they're there looking more at managing the process, automating the process, they're looking at productivity, and they're looking at gaining insight on what's going on in the operation rather than just controlling the concessionaires.
And so in the case of software, does it have to look and feel differently for the Italian, the German, the South American market, or can it look and feel the same way? Do people respond to the same visual aspects as we do here in Malta?
No, this is an interesting science in itself. There are big differences in terms of the user experience that needs to be provided to the different people in the different countries. Our type of product isn't so in tune with that. It doesn't need to be quite so in tune with that. But certainly that is a major issue if you're developing the sort of applications which may be being used by the gaming industry, where the responsiveness of the gamer is actually going to be significantly different depending on how the web page is presented to that person. But you raise an interesting point, because so many of these questions vary, the answers would vary dependent upon the nature of the product or the service that you are trying to internationalize.
Okay, so it sounds actually quite complex. So when should one consider internationalizing a product? Because obviously our local market is pretty small, so you'd expect lots of people to want to sell overseas because it's a much bigger market, but it sounds quite complex. So should you consider?
Well, I think you have to ask, why would you want to internationalize, first of all? And I think the answer to your question would come out as a result of that. Usually people are looking at internationalizing a product or a service because they want to access a larger market than the market they are currently in. I hear you mentioning Malta, but this is relevant from whichever country you're in. If you're operating in the UK, the UK market may actually be limited, relatively speaking, mm-hmm. Compared to us, and one looks to internationalize to the US and a global type market. So you need to start off by actually saying, what is the main driver for internationalizing? And it's often either going to be a matter of accessing a larger market or accessing a different type of market which has a different propensity to spend on your product or your service. Give you an example again, back to our airport example. There's only one airport in Malta. Having achieved the sale to Malta International Airport for our software, the only way of expanding that, should we choose to expand it, is to have actually internationalized, as we did. But one could make a strategic decision not to internationalize in a situation like that and to maintain a smaller market. A small market can also be very profitable, and you can have a much larger market which is a lot less profitable. So you're going for volume rather than the value of the sale. And all of these will be very different depending on the nature of your product and service that you're internationalizing.
And I'm guessing in both senses, it's you're an existing established company that is still continuing to be entrepreneurial. You haven't stopped with your homegrown solutions for the market. Is that how this airport solution came about?
Yes. Ultimately, I'm a firm believer in what is referred to as opportunity identification. So essentially, this is the ability to identify an opportunity to grow a product or provide a service in a particular way which differentiates you from the way that other people are operating within that market. So essentially what we did with that particular product for the airport industry was, having worked with Malta International Airport, we realized that Malta International Airport was particularly advanced in the way that it was handling its non-aeronautical revenues, as they're referred to. We saw that the trends in the whole industry were going the same way that Malta International was leading. And we did our market research, we looked at a competitive analysis, we undertook a competitive analysis, and we decided, yes, this is something that we could try and develop a product for an international market. In doing so, you have to address lots and lots of issues in terms of trying to work out budgets for all sorts of different areas, which we might have the opportunity to discuss.
Yes, it is. What are the other things you need to consider before internationalizing? So you might have language skills, you've done your market research. What are the unexpected things that you've found selling in as many countries as you do? What are the things you've realized that you would like to pass on?
I'm not sure that they were unexpected, because I think we were quite, we had our eyes quite wide open, because we've done this before with other products.
I see.
Previously. So we had the advantage of having been through this process, made some mistakes that we did not want to repeat, and therefore we had a fairly clear idea of what else was required. Certainly in our experience, and I can only talk about our particular product sector of the software products market, and this may vary in different sectors, will certainly vary, I would say. The largest cost for us for the internationalization is the marketing. And I use the term marketing in a very broad sense. So I'm not just talking about promotion. I'm not just talking about producing collateral and brochures and websites, etc., etc. But there's a lot broader mix of things that you need to provide within the marketing umbrella, including exhibiting at trade shows, particularly focused trade shows more than generic trade shows, and also the area of building up awareness very often, particularly if you're coming out with a product which is different to what has been the status quo.
And I'm guessing also you have obviously a much bigger world, so many more people to have relationships with. And so having a relationship management aspect, having more people on the phones, more people keep in contact, as well as raising your awareness, that's got to be a factor that needs to be considered.
Absolutely, and visiting clients. We mustn't underestimate how important it is to actually visit people and speak to people face to face. In today's day and age, we use very effectively emails, we use Skype, we use sort of all sorts of other types of methods of communicating much more cheaply and much more effectively. However, we can't just rely on that. You have to meet people, you have to speak to people face to face. There's a lot more strength in relationship building in doing so. And that's obviously a very expensive thing to do in terms of travel costs and in terms of the time involved in doing that.
And are there things that you told us a story off air about doing business in South Korea, which seemed to be quite interesting. We don't need to discuss that one necessarily, but the things that people do, things, some countries are more social, or some people expect business to be done in a certain way, and it's, how do you become aware of those things? Or,
to be honest, I think it's luck that you come across it, and you may research these sort of things. I'm not particularly in tune with doing that myself, but I think you need to get a feel for the way things are done, particularly in Asia, where things are very different, and also to a certain extent in South America, which is a very different market. The North American and European markets are obviously a lot more similar in this way.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Entrepreneur Clinic on Campus FM with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week, John DiGiorgio of Sherden Software. We're discussing productization and internationalizing your business. So we've discussed about the personal aspects, the communications, legal, marketing types of things. How do people take to a small company from Malta, or, you know, a company from a small island like Malta, in fact, taking over the world? Does that help or does that hinder?
It's an interesting question. Sometimes it helps and sometimes it hinders. This was something that used to come up quite often when we used to exhibit in the USA, which we still exhibit there, but we used to exhibit even more in our previous product. And very often people would say to me, "Where are you from?" And I'd say Malta, and particularly in the US, obviously you then needed to go through the process.
They would ask which state it was in first.
Correct, yes. You'd sort of explain to them where Malta was. And usually what I used to do is, on my computer screen, as a backdrop, I'd actually have a photo which was readily available. And when they asked the question, "Why are you based in Malta?" And they would do it with a certain tone, I would actually just flip my screen onto a photo of a couple of dolphins out at sea, which I once took. And it completely sort of removes the pressure, if you like, on that. And you talk a bit about Malta. But yes, being in Malta very often is something which is considered to be unusual, almost exotic. Although I think that's changing. Malta is becoming more well known as a destination for doing business from. The other thing that I say is that we are exactly in the middle of the 19 time zones that we serve in our client base. So we are pretty much equidistant from the West Coast US, mm-hmm, as we are from Australia and New Zealand.
So we can touch each business day, essentially.
Yes. Australia and New Zealand is obviously more challenging, particularly in the winter or the summer. I think it's the summer, it's more challenging. But it's also good positioning to show yourself as a company which is in the middle of the time zones, because it actually shows your sensitivity to the global world that we're in, and that you are a globally operating company.
And I'm guessing when you show the photographs as well, you can put people's minds at rest that there are lots of nationalities coming to live in Malta, and therefore you have a big pool of skills to be able to choose from?
Yes, and that's happening more and more. So as Malta has become more internationalised itself, an international cosmopolitan in the population living here.
And do you find hiring staff from overseas easy to do, or are you finding, do you hire your staff locally in most cases to be able to help with your internationalisation?
I wouldn't say that we have a policy of employing locally in terms of, from a discriminatory point of view. We don't.
And
we
have not on air.
No. But at the end of the day, for us, the strategy that has worked best for us is taking people very often straight out of university or MCAST and building them up. So we have a good staff retention record, and as a result, our policy of building people up and training people into more senior roles has worked for us. When you're actually hiring people that are coming from overseas, you might not be quite in the same position to do that. Having said that, we have a number of overseas nationals who work within the company, but it's probably less in our case than it seems to be in many other companies' case in our field.
So what are the cost implications if you're not employing people from abroad, so you're not doing any relocations? Are there any other cost implications that need to be factored in when you are internationalising, apart from things like trade shows? Are there other costs that one needs to be aware of?
Yes, certainly. In our case, the marketing cost is by far the largest cost. So there we've got trade shows, we've got promotions, certain amount of advertising that we do, and travel costs to meet customers. So that's certainly very important to us. And those are very big costs. There are other costs that you need to address. Particularly in our case, it's translation and legal are two of the main issues. So we do translate a lot of our documentation and product into a number of languages. And that's something which isn't just a one-time cost, but one's needing to update those on an ongoing basis. And that becomes quite a significant cost. And I mentioned the legal. The legal should not be underestimated, both in terms of understanding contracts, reviewing contracts, and setting contracts which work both for you and for your customer. Usually the pressure is placed by potential customers to use their own jurisdiction as the location for the legal contracts that you go into. And sometimes that pressure is very, very high. We have tended to resist that for a number of reasons. And most of those reasons are related to the actual cost and the ability to defend a legal position. So those two areas are particularly important. There are, of course, other implications to the internationalization that you need to be aware of. Very often you might actually need to conform to certain standards or conform to certain practices within a specific market. I think of the data protection issues, which may be different in the US, for instance, compared to the UK or Europe in general. You need to be aware of those, and you need to understand what the implications may be to the business itself.
What other things do you need to have in place to successfully internationalise? Now, you said you've done this, you're on your second round, essentially, of doing it. What else, if you had a tick list, if you were going to now internationalise another product, what would be, say, the top three things on your tick list outside of marketing?
Luck. Yeah, you need a lot of luck. Actually, more than luck, I think the correct word is serendipity, which essentially is the combination of different things happening and conspiring in a particular way that give you a positive environment. It may be timing, that you're addressing or looking to address a market at a particular time when the market is ready for that type of product or service. It's about the having the right resources available at that time to be able to address that particular market. So that's what I mean by luck. It's a combination of being in the right place at the right time. combining that with the opportunity identification that I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. you need to have the right type of product or service. I'll give you an example. We as a company have quite a broad range of different products, some of which we have actually looked to internationalize, but others we have not. And the reason may be that although the product may be a very good product, it's very difficult to differentiate that product on an international level.
But locally it works perfectly because you've built it for the local market.
Exactly. So if, for instance, I look at our Sherbin Financial Manager as an example, it's a very good product, a very well-accepted product locally, and we do have it being used overseas, but we don't really actively market it overseas for the simple reason that however good the product is, it's very difficult to get any recognition of the product beyond the local market when you're competing against what is probably 1,000 other products, some of which may be nearly as good as ours.
And that's another thing, actually, influencing a market, because of course in Malta everybody knows everybody, the media is quite small, your referrals are quite easy. If you know that so-and-so is using it, then you're more likely to buy. How do you manage to influence an international market? How do you get into international media, the analysts, the big consultants that actually all play a part in these big sales?
Very good question. First of all, the way that we do it, because we're a product and a software product focused company, is not going to be the same across the board, obviously. But in our particular case, what you will find is lots of media are interested to promote your product, but that's very much tied to advertising.
So a bit like locally.
A bit like locally, yes. So that's one situation that you could go down that route, but you've got to ask, is your product the type of product in today's world which is best promoted through advertising, which could be quite expensive? In our industry, a typical half-page advert in a trade magazine in the airport industry is likely to be in the region about £3,000 to £4,000 sterling for half a page advert.
Wow.
So it is extremely expensive to do. A much better way is to use PR. PR from the point of view of writing articles, writing blog posts, and trying to get these distributed. One of the things that we've been very effective at, for instance, is the use of LinkedIn. We created a LinkedIn group specifically focusing on the airport non-aeronautical sector, which didn't exist before, and in fact our product is the first and currently only product in this space available within the industry, so we have an advantage there. And with our LinkedIn group, what we've managed to do is we use that not just to promote our product. Yes, we do put posts about our product every now and then, but actually quite rarely. Most of the time what we're doing is we're posting articles that we see or stories that we see in the broader media. We're reposting them into the LinkedIn group and distributing that to the, I think it's currently 1,200 members of that group.
So it creates discussion, it shows you as market leaders, that type
yes.
of thing, thought leaders.
Essentially, you come across exactly as thought leaders, and if you like, you're the sort of the trusted advisor. And being the trusted advisor for a potential client is a very powerful place to be. When people are looking to you to get advice and opinions on how to do things, and obviously you also have a solution that can allow them to actually address those points.
You'd mentioned about being first to market being an advantage. Is there parts of that that are actually a disadvantage?
Oh, yes, absolutely. What you've got is a situation that when you are, in our case, with the first product into our market space, what you need to do is you need to overcome the status quo pressure. In other words, a lot of people will actually say to you, well, this is how we've been doing it, this is how everyone's been doing it, why should we change? And if it's such a great product that you have, why hasn't anyone else done it? And if it's you that's done it, what are you doing in Malta?
So you get back to...
You're back to that same. Yeah. So people expect the leader in a particular sector to be coming out of the UK, the US, the Hong Kong, wherever it may be, Singapore. So you are battling and you're needing to create the awareness for the need for a product to address that particular sector. And I would say since we have started, the first 2 years was focusing on that.
So now, creating the need almost.
Yes, the perception that people need to look at this. And then of course that starts to drive the demand for the product.
I think you should change your tagline to "There is a better way."
Well, there is a better way, in
fact. So, locally, to be able to take on this massive challenge of conquering the world by selling your products, is there any help locally to enable companies in Malta to achieve this global view?
Yes, definitely I would say yes. First of all, if I look at the legal side, which was one of the last things that we spoke about, today in Malta there are a lot of people who have significant experience of both international operations and particularly in my case the software side of international operations. We have a number of international software companies based in Malta, and that type of skill has been more diffuse. But equally, there are lots of people who have built up experience in search engine optimization, SEO, which is a very important aspect which we didn't have chance to discuss today as part of the marketing mix. There are lots of people who have good experience in that area, and equally in the areas of translation and these types of services. The international marketing side, I would say, is still a bit of an underserved sector currently. So people with specific experience at international marketing in the software side, from my experience.
I see. So maybe if there's anybody out there with international marketing skills, they should start sharing their CVs. But I'd like to thank this week's guest, John DeGiorgio of Sherbin Software. Next week, I'll be talking to Stephen Kakuti Bonavita and David Vella about Altaro Software's journey from startup to success story. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Entrepreneur Clinic with me, Monique Chambers. The programme is aired every Wednesday on Campus FM at 9:30 a.m. and repeated on Thursdays at 1:30 p.m. Join us again next week to hear more about your journey in starting up a new business or launching a new product.